You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon members. Thank you so much.
Join our Patreon for extra episodes, interviews, extra content, and to help support the podcast and help us continue to do the work we do.
Go to patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl to learn more.
I just love the idea of magic as a metaphor for the power that poetry can have.
I'm Jenny Williamson.
And I'm Jen McMenemy.
And this is Ancient History Fangirl. We are so thrilled to welcome Elise John, author of Orphea and Eurydiceus, to the podcast. Elise's novel is a gender-bending interpretation of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, and we are so excited to discuss Orphea, Eurydiceus, and the enduring power of myth. Welcome, Elise.
Yeah, we're so looking forward to this.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
So, what drew you to the story of Orpheus and Eurydice?
I suppose there were a few different reasons. Part of it was quite a personal reason, which is that I was drawn to the story of Orpheus and Eurydice after my brother's death. So I was really motivated to write this book in tribute to my brother. We were very close. And I felt that I could relate really strongly to the themes of the Orpheus myth, like the depth of emotion that you feel when losing someone, the desire to bring them back, the idea of trying to bargain for them in a way. So the story really seemed to fit how I was feeling at the time. Another link was that my brother also liked the aria from Gluck's opera where Orpheus laments Eurydice, and I found that he'd kept a copy of the lyrics, so there was even more personal connection there. I suppose I also felt a bit of an affinity with Orpheus's character because he was a poet and an artist. And I like the idea that his fame came through poetry rather than through combat or fighting. And as I'd been writing for most of my life, including writing poetry, the power of Orpheus's creativity really chimed with me. I loved the idea that his poetry was magical, that it was able to move listeners and even animals and plants, because there was something about that that struck me as being a bit symbolic of the magic of storytelling and art in general. And I was also drawn to showing the struggle of the creative process too, the fact that you have to work at it and learn as Orpheus does in the story. And I suppose the third reason I was drawn to Orpheus's myth was that I was interested in what writing a tragic romance about a creative hero could explore about gender if I made that hero a woman. So there was the dynamic of the famous love story to consider, and also the aspects of artist and muse and how a gender swapped version of the story could play around with ideas about who is the wooing party, who is the courted one, who is the creative genius, and who is more of the inspiration. So all of those elements were really interesting to me.
I'm really interested in this idea of the grief aspect of this. I really feel that, you know, like it's always been a myth to me that speaks to our desire to bring back the people that we love.
Yeah, I think there's something about funerary traditions in the modern day that can seem very abrupt, definitely Western funerary traditions. It's you have a funeral and it seems like it's over. And then in some other traditions, there's much more storytelling and remembering that goes on. And so I suppose some of that sense of a desire to bring someone back can come out of the sense that we're not done with them. We still want that relationship to be ongoing, I think.
Why did you decide to retell this myth by swapping the genders of the hero and heroine? What were you looking to show or expose or play with by swapping the genders?
On one level, it seemed like a very instinctive choice because the seeds of the retelling came from thinking about myself trying to bring back my brother in my own life. So in that sense, it was an obvious choice for Orpheus to be a woman trying to rescue a man. But there were also some aspects that I think seemed ripe for thinking about gender and trying to maybe subvert the default thinking or the traditional roles that have been reinforced over the centuries. So one of those was the heroism aspect, the idea of the creator hero or the creative hero. So I was aware of how we've historically seen heroes as often male and also creative geniuses as male and in our cultural memory. So although that dates from ancient times, you know, it's also quite recent in some ways. I was thinking, just thinking about BBC's Sherlock and the fandom around this male genius character, for example. And I was interested in kind of playing around with both of those things at once to explore how we could center women in new ways as hero character of the story, and also how we could really respect and celebrate women as really intelligent and really artistic. And Orpheus in the myths is this publicly celebrated figure who inspires widespread awe. So gender swapping the Orpheus and Eurydice characters gave me this opportunity to put a woman in that role of this kind of dazzling, celebrated artist figure, and also to explore what it means for an artist to be a hero in that sense. And I think in some ways, stories that excavate the voice of a female character, as there have been so many wonderful ones recently from myth, that they're also really important. And I think a story that then puts the woman into the role of hero does something different, and they're both, you know, complementary to each other in some ways. So I like that Orphea could use her creative talents to overcome monsters or to take on a daring feat in a quest, and that she's aware of the heroic potential to win glory through her poetry. And there are these discussions about fame and legacy in the story as well. And I suppose part of it, the creative side of it, was the idea of the artist and muse and how that's often been this gender binary and wanting to flip that around and to do that and ask what is the experience like for a woman artist in a patriarchal society who wants to achieve greatness, and then what is it like for a man, on the other hand, to be content to be her support in a society that expects men to be, you know, warriors or breadwinners. Is there something exciting about that or different about that? So I wanted to explore that a little bit in the story.
Orphea is a poet and she's also a warrior. And I was thinking about how in the ancient world, it would potentially, correct me if I'm wrong, Jen, but potentially have been just as subversive to show a woman being a warrior as to show a woman being a poet.
I don't know. I kind of disagree with you, Jenny. I think, you know, we find a lot of the times in the ancient graves and funerary stuff, we see a lot of evidence of martial women. As I was reading this, I thought it was much more subversive to show Orphea being this sort of poet and how her voice had the ability to change and move the world. From my point of view, I've seen so many incredible retellings. I'm working on a retelling. And one of the things that I love is seeing a martial woman. And I think what I liked about this was, yes, Orphea is very martial and she knows how to fight and she can hold her own against men. But the interesting thing in this society is more what happens when a woman uses her voice. And I haven't seen it done this way before. And it's one of the things that really drew me to this book and helped me connect with Orphea.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because I'm definitely aware of characters like the Amazons and, of course, Atalanta being these powerful martial women too. I think it's that thing where you never want women characters to be forced into one box where they have to be either, you know, kick butt characters or artistic or one thing, but for there to be different kinds of women together existing.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things, we did a whole season on gender in particularly ancient Greece and Rome. And what you see a lot for many women is they're either erased their roles as being having any sort of power, or particularly when you get into like the middle classes, they're kind of kept from having power unless they're operating through men. It's particularly awful in places like Athens. But then you see in the lower classes, in martial women, in myths of people like Atalanta and Artemis, there is a power that women have. But I don't see it that often as being the power to tell stories or to shape narratives, with the exception of Aspasia, who was the philosopher's philosopher. And she was the longtime concubine of Pericles and maybe even a madam of her own brothel. That's what the rumors say.
Still working through men, though, in a sense, because we get her voice through male philosophers writing about what she said.
Yep. I mean, you have Sappho, but, you know, again, that's fragmentary poetry. some of the most beautiful fragmentary poetry. I think you have a Sappho quote at the beginning of your book, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. That quote really spoke to me. And I think definitely there's always going to be evidence that women were many, many different things. But as to whether that's been celebrated enough or, you know, explored enough in histories and in stories is a different matter.
This kind of leads right into my next question. Orphea is raised as a hero and taught to be proficient in spear and sword and forbidden to study poetry initially. Why did you decide to make her martial training so important?
I think one of the things that interested me was this idea of contrast. So in some ways, her martial training, it's a contrast with her creative side, like the idea of the pen and the sword, or in this case, the lyre and the spear. And it provides a choice of a sort between different kinds of power. So there's the sort of power that she doesn't want to have, and then the sort of power that is more appealing to her, the creative power. So on one hand, you have strength through force, through combat, through conquest, martial power. And then on the other hand, you have poetry and storytelling and song as an alternative to that, the magic of words and a kind of power of persuasion of that too. So I wanted Orphea to have those martial arts thrust upon her, but for her to ultimately want to be a poet instead, so she can more confidently choose poetry over the spear, because she knows what fighting is like, what it involves, what consequences it has too, not just on a one-to-one combat level, but also philosophically, politically, in terms of how we should approach each other and how we should live, which is something that Eurydiceus thinks about too. I also like the idea that by training and having that martial training, it gives her a kind of powerful physicality. And even though she comes to reject the martial lifestyle, she remains this woman who is quite physically strong. And Eurydiceus, on the other hand, is more on the slender side. So they're both kind of playing against type for their genders, I suppose. And I was interested in what it could be like to portray Orphea as a physically strong woman who is also a romantic lead, because I think it can be important to break the association between womanhood and smallness and manhood and largeness, because those sort of beauty ideals can be quite dangerous. They can reinforce body shaming and lead to poor mental health. So I wanted to show a contrast between, in the story, how characters like Dionysus view Orphea's physicality, which is something that really threatens the expectation of female obedience and symbolically, physically does, and so it must be mocked and attacked by him, versus how Eurydiceus views Orphea's physicality as something beautiful and exciting. And then equally, Orphea is drawn to Eurydiceus and isn't at all affected by the fact that he doesn't resemble the strongest warrior on the field. So there's a kind of liberty, a kind of body liberty as well in that too, in how they find each other.
She really seems to take the lead, right, romantically. So that kind of follows in with like breaking stereotypes as well.
Yeah, that was something I was very conscious of too, because I think as a reader, I'm always looking for that kind of story, and I find it quite hard to find that sort of book where you have a woman who's more leading in romance. And I really enjoy that kind of story myself. So I definitely was aware of that in writing it too.
Jenny and Jen here to tell you all about a novel we really love, Orphea and Eurydiceus by Elise John.
Pip Williams, author of The Dictionary of Lost Words, has this to say, quote, "As I read Orphea and Eurydiceus, I imagined the muses beside Elise John, focusing her mind and guiding her hand. The writing is poetic and evocative, and the story will thrill readers who have long suspected something is missing from the classics of Greek myth."
Orphea has been raised as a warrior, but her heart sings with poetry, and her words hold tremendous power. But her father, the sun god Apollo, has forbidden her from using this power. Her romance with the young shieldmaker Eurydiceus gives her the confidence to defy her father, winning the patronage of the powerful muses. Under their tutelage, she hones her craft and strengthens the magic she was born to wield.
However, as her relationship with Eurydiceus deepens, she feels the call toward adventure and fame. She finds all of that by joining the Argonauts on their quest for the Golden Fleece. Still, she longs to return to her gentle shieldmaker.
Yet when she does, a darker journey begins, one that will call on all the powers of her poetry to fight for the man she loves.
You can purchase Orphea and Eurydiceus on Amazon, the HarperCollins website, or anywhere books are sold.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Hey, Jenny, do you ever feel like you just have to get something off your chest?
Doesn't everybody?
Absolutely. You know, we all carry around lots of different stressors, both big and small. And when we bottle that stuff up, it really affects us negatively.
It can affect all aspects of our lives if we don't deal with it. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down.
One of the things that therapy has really helped me with is learning how to set boundaries. They allow me to unburden some of the stress by saying, right, this is what I can and can't deal with. And I would not have got there, Jenny, without therapy.
Yeah, I think therapy has helped me keep things in perspective, you know, because I think that when you get all up in your head, it's really easy to let negative thoughts spiral out of control. I think talking to a therapist can really help you take some of that stuff off your mind. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/AHFG today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/AHFG.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So Orphea is the daughter of Apollo, the god of poetry and music, amongst many other things. But her father doesn't want her to learn music or poetry. And this is a departure from the original myth, I think. I mean, there's many versions of this myth. Why did you choose to have Apollo forbid his daughter to learn these arts?
I think something that's really interesting about myth to me is that it's so big and it's so broad. It's these stories that have endured through centuries and how broad they are. But there's always something very specific and individual that makes us relate to a particular myth. And I was thinking about this in terms of this particular idea, because as a writer, I know just how much struggle most of us experience today to have a creative career, especially if you're not wealthy and if you experience some exploitation from the industry. There's this constant struggle to just carve out enough time for your art, to make enough money to even just continue as an artist, let alone to have any sort of stability, to not be exhausted from what you're juggling to make ends meet. And so often, I think writers today have to fight just to be writers, to have a writing career. So I wanted to bring this into the story, but in a slightly different way. So Orphea has to fight to be a poet because her father, Apollo, feels that she should be able to defend herself physically, and that ultimately this is the best way to protect herself against a prophecy. So he thinks his intentions are good, but they don't match what she wants to do with her life. So she has to really push against this if she wants to be a poet. She has to kind of push against his will, which is a divine will. And in some ways it felt symbolic of how so many creatives have to really fight and push to do what they want to do, whether it's fighting your family's ideas about your life or a different plan for you, or fighting for the economic stability to do your job, or fighting to get past other hurdles. I felt that kind of link with this sort of symbolic link with that part of the story. But another reason I was interested in changing Apollo's attitude a bit was that it allowed me to contrast him with the community of the muses and to give the muses a bit more of that artistic mentoring role in Orphea's life. So instead of being taught by one god, she's taught in the arts and trained in the arts by a group of goddesses, a kind of female community. And I was interested in thinking about women's knowledge communities and women's artistic communities and how it can be empowering for a woman artist to be around female mentors too, and in a sort of female environment when that's less common in the society.
I really relate to this idea of fighting to do your art and fighting for the breathing space in your life to do your art when you have forces pushing against that and pushing you into a certain role and pushing you into, I mean, we all live in capitalism, earning a living in something different, you know, like that's very near to both of our experience as well.
Absolutely. It's hard, and it's very difficult to put value on things that are your art that you're not being paid for until you are being paid for it. And even then, you know, the time, the cost to time is so difficult because we're so ingrained to think of it as the monetary cost and reward as opposed to like the fulfillment of your soul.
The island Orphea grows up on is filled with women, and many of them are gagged and forbidden to speak. Women do not have any agency, but Orphea does. And while Orphea's martial training grants her a certain status among the people of the palace, it's her words that inspire fear. What does the ability of a woman to speak, tell stories, and shape narratives mean to this world? And why does it cause such fear in your version of the myth?
It's such a great question. I think something that's true of women speaking out, but also of any power minority speaking out, is that any group that has enjoyed dominance in the halls of power then feels threatened by others simply having a voice. It's something we just see time and time again. It shouldn't be that way, but to hear an alternative perspective getting more attention is to be aware that your dominance may be threatened. So I think Orphea then frightens men who don't want to share that power with women. There's the potential that if one woman speaks up and tells stories about women and about her own feelings and experiences, the other women might find commonality and might eventually find community. And it's the same fear that in the story leads to some of the goddesses being tricked and kept away from Orphea when she appears on Mount Olympus. There's a fear of what can happen if there's a kind of chain reaction here. And I think that the idea of a voice as frightening to institutionalized power, it's been really relevant to recent events in my country, Australia, too. We had a referendum last year on what was actually called a voice to parliament, which was a way of enshrining Indigenous people here to have a voice on their own affairs in the political scheme. And Australia, to its great shame, rejected that proposal for an Indigenous voice. It was actually called the Voice Campaign. And the right-wing campaign against the voice, it really harnessed some of the fears in the ambiguity of that word voice. The case that they were making was, if Indigenous people in Australia have a political voice, then what might happen next? What might they take away from white people? You know, it was this appalling and horrifying reminder of how fear of marginalized voices is so often a fear of a chain reaction for those in power, and how it just terrifies those who've enjoyed an unjust amount of power. So it was a timely reminder, I guess, of this theme and the idea that just somebody speaking up can be frightening to others.
It's really shocking that they would just be that bold about it, like just saying it right out. Well, if these people have a voice, what happens next?
It is really, yeah, it's quite shocking. And especially as an Australian who's traveled to New Zealand and you see the contrast in how much progress New Zealand has made on these issues. But just the fact that the word voice was everywhere was this big reminder of that. And I think it really was a sense of the ambiguity that was harnessed and weaponized against it. The fear of a voice was really central to that campaign, because previously when we had a plebiscite on same-sex marriage, you know, you can't really scare many people with any ambiguity about the word same-sex marriage. Everyone knows what it means. Everyone knows what they're voting on. But once the word voice this time entered the political discussion, it became this thing that the right were trying to turn into something like a bogeyman and frighten people with. So it does, you know, serve as a reminder to some extent of how terrified people can be of just the concept of a voice and what it could lead to.
Yeah, and you have the, particularly on that island, the images that really stuck with me are the images of the poor women, the serving women who are gagged and forced to sort of clean naked in the palace hallways. And it's just, you know, the idea that they have no voice, they have no autonomy, is just really deeply unsettling. And I'm just like, yeah, that is horrifying and not so far removed from how it would have looked in the ancient world.
It's interesting because Orphea, as we've discussed, is a martial woman on this island. And as far as I remember, she's the only martial woman on the island. So her martiality, her ability to literally kill, is seen as less scary than her having a voice and women around her having a voice, like an ability to tell the story from their own point of view.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I suppose there's also a sense that her martial training is something that's taken a fair amount of time as well, whereas if you think of people speaking up, it's something that could catch fire quite quickly in a sense.
And the biggest fear is their actual voice, is them speaking to someone else, is them having a narrative, bringing across their stories and their culture and their history. And, you know, we covered the servile wars in ancient Rome. And a lot of that is about someone's voice catching fire and leading a rebellion.
Yeah, so much of reading about that period is really quite shocking. I mean, I spent a lot of time reading about things that didn't make it into the book, but reading about slavery in Sparta, for example, was just so horrifying. And not only for women, but for men too, just you know, the things that people had to live with was truly shocking. I was thinking you must have an absolute wealth of knowledge into other things that relate to this too, from Rome and from different areas that you've looked at as well.
Yeah, particularly the worship of Dionysus, but also at her goddess. She was the goddess of the first Servile War. She's a Syrian mermaid goddess. He's utterly fascinating. We covered her in our book. But yeah, this idea of this sort of like people being able to have their own culture and talk and exchange with each other was terrifying to those who had enslaved them.
Yeah, the fact that these same tactics have been used in different times and periods, and these same things have been seen as frightening to those in power across different eras and in different settings.
As we've talked about, Orpheia is drawn to music, poetry, and the spoken word. And like the original Orpheus from the original myth, the natural world reacts to her storytelling prowess. Rocks, trees, and the ground obey her commands. What was it like writing a character with such an incredible power?
Well, it was a really wonderful experience. I just love the idea of magic as a metaphor for the power that poetry can have, and really for creative expression of any kind. Orpheia's poetry magic to some extent reflects how stories can cause emotion to bloom and spread, and how they can not only convey someone else's feelings, but help us to feel ourselves. I really like the idea that this power could be symbolic too of how it feels as a reader, or in ancient times, a listener, when you have these moments of intense connection with the story. So Eurydiceus feels the power of Orpheia's work and it lights up his life. Orpheia herself feels the power of Calliope's poetry and of the goddess Hera's way of speaking. Even Jason, who isn't particularly respectful to others in this story, has to recognize that Orpheia's storytelling is powerful because it can reach people, and in doing so, it can give poetic testimony, it can bear witness through metaphor and simile. So it's not only the impact of the magic of the story on the storyteller, but on others too. And I like the idea that this could be a kind of metaphor for that. I found it interesting too that in Ovid's version of the Orpheus and Eurydice story, unlike in Virgil's version, Orpheus makes this extended poetry performance appealing to Hades, and we actually get to enjoy that. He has this vocal speech, and it's an intense moment where he uses poetry to try to win back the woman he loves. So it's kind of poetry as persuasion. Poetry is the best tool or weapon he has to try to change the situation. And it's a heroic moment, really. But I think, because some of the famous ancient heroes have their heroic moments being about combat, like Achilles, for example, I like the idea that Orpheus could have this big grand moment using poetry instead. I think it shows something about the power of language and the power of art. And I suppose another aspect of it, in terms of, you know, rocks, trees, and the ground, as you mentioned, was I had the chance to visit Greece for research for the book, and I really loved being able to weave some of the natural elements into the descriptions of place and of the flora and fauna from Mount Olympus and Mount Parnassus and some of the other places that I visited too.
Yeah, you really get a sense of the physicality of the landscape in this book, which I really appreciated. I've been to Greece as well. I love the landscape. I think it's just absolutely gorgeous and really different from where I grew up and where I live. So it's just really fun to see that.
I think I was very fortunate in that when I was trekking on Mount Parnassus and Mount Olympus, at one point I had a guide who, his dad had done a PhD in the endemic plants of Greece. So not only was he himself a local, but he also had this really rich depth of knowledge. And he took me through the olive grove at the bottom of Mount Parnassus and showed me the olive cultivation, and we talked about plants. And so it was really just fascinating. And at every stage, there was something that just reminded me of the Orpheus story, something symbolic about how the olive trees grew, how they were kind of cut and then would grow up again, and how there was this beauty in that, I suppose, the sort of persistence of it, the way that the branches would grow together. It was, yeah, there was something very beautiful about those specific details of place that really spoke to me.
So Orpheia is one of the Argonauts, a fact that is usually forgotten about. What was it like writing about the incredible quest of the Argonauts and Orpheia's role in their mission?
It was really fascinating, and in a way, it was quite tough to limit myself to just the bits that are in the final story in the novel, because some of those adventures the Argonauts have are just so colourful and so wild and so interesting and deserving of their own stories, I think. I was really interested in how Orpheia might relate to the personalities among the Argonauts and those who are sailing on the quest, like how would she relate to Atalanta, to Medea, to Jason? It's different in each case. it's a ship full of big personalities. Some of them might be like new friends, and others might be dangerous, and others she might relate to in a more complicated way, as with Medea. But in terms of the events of the Argonautica, I particularly love the idea of Orpheus getting to experience those moments, like the actual stealing of the Golden Fleece, the attack on the ship from the Sirens, and using her poetry as Orpheus was meant to have done. You know, the idea that she's kind of recruited for her poetry, that everyone has something different to contribute to the quest. I was fascinated by Medea. I'd studied the play Medea when I was younger, and I've always been a bit obsessed with it. And I think she certainly has this extraordinary input to the quest, both through her skills and also her ruthlessness and her ability to act in a crisis. And so I suppose also, given how much we associate writing these days with just sitting alone in a room at the computer, the idea that a poet like Orpheus was out there taking on magical creatures during an epic quest was pretty fascinating too. So there were all these different elements that I loved about it, but it was definitely hard to contain it to just that. There's so much more in that original story.
I always find with Medea, I always think a lot of people know the final story, right? They know the play where she gets away with it in the end. And so many people forget about this part of the story where she's pretty much helping Jason do everything that he needs to do in order to accomplish his quest. I always find it fascinating when we have retellings, when people, you know, spend that time to give us this other version of Medea, who is raised by the most ruthless god/sorcerer and who makes decisions that are utterly baffling and fascinating at the same time.
I had this conversation with a different author one time about choosing to write a story that involved some really big personalities of history and what a challenge that is. You know, if Shakespeare and different authors have written this character all down through the ages, like it's so intimidating to try it yourself. What is your opinion on making these characters your own when there's so much backstory and like how these characters have been handled by others?
Yeah, I think, of course, it can feel really challenging because you're aware of those ancient stories like Medea and like the Argonautica, like the Iliad and the Odyssey. But I think I'm aware that when I'm writing or retelling to some extent, I'm making my own versions of these characters. And I suppose this book really prominently does that with the gender swapping too. So there's that tension between what you take from the old stories and what you shape or reconfigure, how much of the character is what is there in the earlier versions, and then how much of it is your own spin on that. So I wouldn't say that it stopped me in any sense. I enjoy working with those two elements of it and thinking about how I want to shape it to the particular story that I wanted to tell. I think in terms of big personalities, definitely Medea and Jason were up there. I always found it interesting how in the play Medea, she kind of gets away with it because that's so unusual. The fact that the play ends with Jason kind of impotently waving his fist at her and launching this tirade at her, and then she flies off in a chariot pulled by dragons. It was just incredible, and especially given how many Greek tragedies punish the hero for their hubris, you can't help but kind of wonder who is really hubristic in this story. Is it Medea or is it actually Jason? And so I felt like those were questions open for exploration to some extent. I thought Jason was really interesting to think about, to consider and reconsider too. I always found the word hero a bit strange for Jason, so I wanted to explore that a little bit as well, and also to kind of integrate him into this version with Orpheus and Eurydiceus, that he has some relationship with each of them as well that adds an extra layer of tension to the part with the quest too.
She's one of my favorite characters in myth. I really sadly relate to her on a lot of levels. I don't know if that's like a confession I should be making in public, but
I mean, I think that explains the duality of our natures, right? Like you relate to Medea and I relate more to Atalanta. And you've got Orpheus in this story, who is a really good blending of having both magic and martial abilities and how she relates to both sides of who she is.
Pele, Hawaiian goddess of volcanoes, fire, and rebirth.
Maeve, Celtic warrior queen and nemesis of heroes.
Kiyohime, Japanese fire-breathing snake demon.
Pesta, Norwegian spirit of the Black Death. Our book, Women of Myth, is a fascinating look at women and femme characters in world mythology, including goddesses, heroines, and monsters. With captivating illustrations by Ringo Award-nominated artist Sarah Richard, it's the perfect gift for the mythology lover in your life, including yourself.
Find Women of Myth wherever books are sold.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello everyone, it's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
I'm a massive fan of Hera. I think she gets a real bum rap in a lot of retellings, and in a lot of stories, she tends to be the real easy villain of every piece. And I really liked Orpheus' affinity for the Queen of the Gods. Could you tell us a little bit about your interpretation of her and how Orpheus feels about her?
Yeah, absolutely. I think she's such a rich and complex character, and it was hard to just get everything I wanted about her into this one story, given that she's not the main focus of the story, because when I was in Greece, I was actively looking to visit sites related to Medea, thinking about, you know, if I wrote another story entirely about Medea. So I went to the place where she was meant to have buried her children and had a look at the Temple of Hera there by the water. And so she was very much front of my mind. And I agree with you that I think these other elements of her story aren't, you know, shown enough, and that they're so ripe for exploration. I was also interested in, you know, if Orpheus is a woman in this version, how does she then relate to these epic female characters from myth, like Medea, like Atalanta, because they all have different talents. So, you know, which ones is there going to be more affinity with, and how she kind of assesses and understands Medea as someone who is quite complex and is also at a different stage of self-understanding to perhaps she is when they meet.
Yeah, I really like the idea that Hera isn't just the enemy of other women, you know, in this book. Like, she's an ally at some points. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but she's not, like, necessarily always the villain, right? And I don't know as much about all the myths as Jen does, so please forgive me if I screw this up, but my impression is that she's frequently smiting women that Zeus has slept with out of fits of jealousy, which is basically just the foundation of the patriarchy, is setting women against other women. So I like that you subverted that.
Absolutely. I'm really interested in Hera. I think ever since my very first encounter with the Greek myths, Hera was like my favorite character. The version of the stories about Hera that I read when I was very, very young, and this would have been, you know, a picture book or something, I remember that it used the word smite. Hera was trying to smite someone, and I was like, this is fantastic, you know, because as a very little girl, the idea of a woman smiting someone wasn't really in my world at that time. So I was just like, I want to learn more about her. And then I was fascinated by the power that she had. And when I went on to read the Iliad, the fact that she could essentially stop things and stop Zeus and be so partisan as well and take sides, she was a really interesting character to me. And yet there was something where I felt it was almost like she was at times a convenient excuse in how Zeus would go around seducing and at times, you know, it was implied that he was raping women. And then the attention would sort of be shifted away from Zeus because Hera would come in and attack these women. And then our focus would shift to her as the one who was, you know, behaving poorly and being jealous and violent and dangerous. And so in that process, you kind of forgot a little bit about what Zeus had done. So I felt that it was not quite how I wanted to portray Hera in that sense. And I think also if we are going through a phase where a lot of people are rethinking gender in these myths, then it doesn't make sense to keep Hera as this kind of petty, jealous figure when she's the most powerful goddess figure among all of the gods. So I wanted to explore that a little bit. And I love the idea that Orphea, as a poet, could particularly pray to Hera and relate to Hera, that she could also have some role with certain other characters in the book. I don't want to spoil too much, but that she could be kind of integrated a bit more into the story as a powerful figure who is involved with women as well.
Yeah, and I think the worship of Hera is really interesting because she is the goddess of women, right? So women prayed to her. And I think, you know, our friend Liv, who hosts Let's Talk About Myths Baby, will say it all the time. These are the stories that have come down to us, but there are other stories. There were reasons that Hera was considered the goddess of women, right?
Was she the goddess of women or the goddess of marriage?
I think marriage and also women, but I could be wrong.
I think I've heard that as well, that it was marriage and women, but I'm not entirely sure if there's one definitive answer to that.
And it depends on the time and the place and the stories, but so much of worship is lost because it was mythic cults and all those kinds of things. But the more we're uncovering, the more it makes us interrogate those stories a little more and think about what women would have saw in Hera for all of her flaws and why they would have had an affinity for her. What I love about your book is that, you know, you do center her in a way that I felt made sense and also brought her to the forefront as not a villain.
Thank you. I found it very interesting that when I went to Greece and a lot of places, I was looking to get a statue of Hera or to find some object with Hera in it, because everywhere you went, you would see all of these different things for sale with Greek gods and goddesses on them. And it was really hard to find one with Hera. And I remember going into one shop and just saying that I was looking for a statue of Hera. And I just remember the look I got from the guy who was selling them, like, really? You want Hera? What are you doing? You know, her bad reputation has lasted a very long time. And I don't want to, you know, attempt to sort of wash the myths in a sense that we make, you know, women good and men bad, which I don't think is great either. But I think that to some extent we have to question when the portrayals of women and goddesses can feel a little bit shallow or dated or ripe for further exploration. So that was definitely how I personally felt about Hera.
It just blows my mind that if Hera was the goddess of women, then, I mean, she's not portrayed as being particularly kind to women a lot of the time in the original myths.
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding too, that she's often, you know, punishing the women that Zeus has snatched off, kind of reacting to that and that then shifts attention away from Zeus's behavior.
And I think that's super important, Jenny, because Hera is a tool of the patriarchy, just like Athena is in the myths that come down to us, right? In the stories that have survived. And I think one of the things about Hera that we've talked about before is like, Hera couldn't punish her husband for being, you know, a shit. So she punishes other women. And if you think about the way in which the structure of upper class houses would have been, many of those women who were married to great thinkers and philosophers and warriors couldn't punish their husbands for being a shit. Instead, they did it to the women around them who were their husbands' victims. You know, we talked about it when we talked about sex workers. Like, we're seeing the actual structure of society being played out again in the worship of the Olympian gods, which is wild.
Yeah, I think issues around consent and sexual assault and these issues have been really prominent in Australia recently too. We had a case where it was alleged that a woman was sexually assaulted in Parliament House, and it's been in the news a lot, and there's been a lot of issues with domestic violence. And also with that has come some consciousness of how these things are reported. And I think one of the things that can be quite striking is when the grammatical subject is kind of removed from a sentence and we hear, you know, 20 women have been assaulted so far this year, and then who's doing the assaulting, is removed from that sentence. There's no subject there. It's not men assaulted 20 women this year. It's just 20 women were assaulted, right? So to some extent, I was thinking about how stories and how the way we discuss these things can actually kind of remove the subject or remove attention from the subject of who is doing that. So I had that in mind as well, too.
So we haven't talked a lot about Eurydiceus yet. Eurydiceus is a healer and a shield maker in your book, and he's very different from the other men that Orphea has met. What draws her to him, and why does she fall for him? And what drew you to tell this love story in this way?
Thank you for asking about Eurydiceus, because I always want to talk about him more. I really see how we can subvert gender stereotypes of women as being connected to how we can subvert gender stereotypes for men as well. I think they're sides of the same coin, really. But I think that it's kind of odd. We're at this cultural moment where female characters who take on these traditionally male attributes and behaviors are very popular, but I think it's rarer to actually see male characters with traditionally feminine attributes being positioned as romantic leads. So I wanted to really celebrate, male characters who are a little bit different to the gendered expectations of lovers. And with Eurydiceus, I was interested in challenging the kind of traditional portrayal of romantically desirable men as being leaders in the sense of being ambitious, martial, protective. So I deliberately tried to portray Eurydiceus as being quite gentle, peace-seeking, supportive of Orphea, and really shunning leadership roles and fame, which is not to say that he's not talented or strong in his own ways, but they aren't those traditional ways. And I also wanted him to have a kind of non-traditional male beauty. So he's quite delicate and vulnerable, and he has a sort of softness to him, which I think is a little bit at odds with the way that masculinity is typically constructed and expressed. So in the romance, I was also aware that female characters in epics and myths are often kind of dazzled by the talents and the feats of the male hero. So I wanted to, on the other hand, show the woman in this scenario kind of dazzling the man, inspiring awe and amazement. And I think an important part of this was that Eurydiceus is someone who enjoys that, who enjoys being dazzled, who prefers to play a more supportive role to her ambition. And he has talents of his own. He has this extraordinary talent as a shield maker, but he doesn't want worldwide glory or conquest or fame. And then that's very attractive to Orphea, who has mostly been around men and kings and gods who want to control others and cause damage through those actions. So Eurydiceus, he represents a gentler kind of masculinity. So I feel that, yeah, I wasn't really looking to only rethink gender for the woman, but I also wanted to rethink gender to some extent for the man as well. And I suppose, you know, part of this also comes from me as like a bisexual writer. I generally feel like I'm not quite within those sort of heterosexual default areas, but it's also the way that the characters were constructed along those lines too, with them both being bisexual, and there's this kind of connection that they have through that as well.
I've grown up writing and reading romance, and it's really true. Like, it is rare to find that sort of subverted masculinity. Like, even if you see subverted femininity, because there's a lot of martial women in romance. There's a lot of women who learn how to sword fight. That's really fun. I always love seeing that. But there's not a lot of men who are not necessarily traditionally masculine. Not saying they don't exist, but it's harder to find that.
I always think it's interesting to think about some of the aspects of masculinity that are quite stereotypically held up culturally, you know, like physical strength, like financial success or career success, ambition, protectiveness, and then to think about like why as a woman you would be looking for those things and to question it a little bit. And then that opens up this whole other area that you can look into. So there's so many different ways for men to be, and I'm really interested in exploring that. And I'm also really drawn to stories that explore that. I have to say that I really loved a book I read recently, which was Girl, Goddess, Queen by Bea Fitzgerald, which is a Hades and Persephone story. And I'm not traditionally the market for a Hades Persephone story. And I love this one because it was so subversive, both with how Persephone is portrayed and also how Hades is portrayed as this really artistic and gentle and interesting character who also rejects warfare. And yeah, I felt that was also quite a refreshing read. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we had Bea on the show last season or the season before. I think she called her Hades. I think she called her Hades a soft boy. And I was like, that is a perfect description. And I think she just does such a good job of, in both of her characters, but of also giving us a Hades who's not like a dark, grumbling presence, but like an artistic and different character. And I really think that it's so good to see those interpretations of gods and masculinity, particularly, I mean, obviously always in romance, but particularly in my opinion in YA, because I think sometimes, I mean, I love a good dark hero, but I worry a little bit about expectations.
I love a good dark hero too, but I'm also, you know, I'm also interested in and always open to things that push the stereotypes and flip them.
Yeah, I think having a wide range of things is always good for us as readers and as writers.
And I love the idea that he's a shield maker, and the way that you describe it as creating shields that are sort of this like quarter inch of material like between someone's life and death. I thought it was very poetic, but also really profound and interesting. And how did you come upon that as a profession for him? Because you're really filling in a lot of blanks with the original character of Eurydice, right?
Yeah, I mean, we know so little about her in the original stories, and there's not a lot of a sense of the dynamic between them. You know, as I mentioned at the very start, the seeds of this story was really my brother dying. And so while I didn't want to write a story about siblings, I wanted it to become something very different, to be a romance. There were still some ways that I was interested in kind of making little tributes to my brother in the story. And he was a very creative person. He was a software engineer, and he was also loved to write. He was a photographer, and he had this way of being very focused on thinking about how can we improve things? How can we improve the system? He always wanted to find a way to use software to make big environmental changes to stop climate change. And he was thinking, you know, how can the little things we do in our specific work eventually achieve something good? So I was thinking about this with Eurydiceus, that the fact that a shield was something that, while it was a defense in ancient times, it could also be used to hurt someone. You could also, you know, use that spike or the sort of part of the shield that could inflict damage. And so if you were to rethink that system, if you were really interested in pacifism, what kind of shield would he then make? How would he use his creativity? And how you can marry this sense of focus on something very specific, like crafting a shield, looking at the fine details of it, with a big picture goal. So that was that philosophical aspect that underlies what he's doing was of interest to me. And I suppose that was something where it was very natural to write, because I was thinking of how my brother had been like that, how the conversations we'd have would often be about wanting to find a way to do something good, to find a way to make the world better, or to think about how systems could be improved. Those were the things we would often discuss. So I tried to bring that a little bit into the story too.
It's really profound.
And a really beautiful tribute to your brother. That's really amazing.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Was there anything that you particularly enjoyed about writing in the underworld, or any of the gods that we haven't touched on who really fascinated you? I always get annoyed at the end of the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, because after things turn out the way they do, Orpheus is very bitter and he eventually runs afoul of some maenads. And I thought you handled that ending really well. Is there anything that we haven't touched, anything about writing in the underworld or the gods of death that you want to talk about?
There were definitely a few things about the underworld and about that aspect of Orpheus' story that I found really compelling and interesting, and I wanted to write about. So one was the motivation, like why Orpheus would succeed or fail, as the case may be, in what he was trying to do. And I think that's often been a key thing in how people react to Orpheus, whether they feel frustrated with him or whether they empathize with him. And it was brought up really beautifully in a film from 2019 called Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I don't know if you know that film. It's a French movie.
Of course.
Yeah, it's this beautiful queer love story between two women, one of whom is hired as the portrait artist of the other woman. The other woman is a noblewoman who's going to be married off to a man, and they develop this relationship. And there's a part where the women are all sitting around reading the story of Orpheus and Eurydice from the Metamorphoses. And one of them, who is the housemaid, has probably never read this story before. It seems like she's hearing it for the first time. And she just reacts with absolute horror to Orpheus. She's just like disgusted at his behavior, basically, and saying, "You're a horrible man. How could he do this? How could he behave this way?" And then the other women are trying to discuss and analyze and explain it a little bit. And it threw up for me watching that film how emotional our response can be to Orpheus depending on how we understand his actions. So I was thinking about, if I make Orpheus a woman, are there certain aspects of gender that might influence how she then thinks about Hades and about the task that she has set? How might those things play into it? And to try to show a little bit of the mental process there, I suppose. So I was very interested in that part of it and exploring that. Another part of the underworld that I found very interesting is just how much writing about this horrifying place that's full of smoke and is boiling hot and is intimidating just to walk through chimed with what I was experiencing as I worked on those scenes, because it happened to be when the fires were happening in Australia and the air was just choked and disgusting. And most people describe that time just going outside and breathing was like being in the apocalypse. It really was apocalyptic. And you had this bushfire smoke drifting across the country. You felt like your eyelids were glued to your eyes. It was difficult to breathe. The air quality was, I think, a lot worse than Beijing for a very long time. So as I was working on that part of the book, all of that was happening around me. And I was interested in trying to even just briefly convey the physicality of that too, and the idea that the underworld could be this sort of frightening place that perhaps had some ties to how the real world can be when it's in those kind of extreme climate conditions. This threat of fire and smog and smoke is becoming real to more people. I think part of the stakes for me was that at that time, a huge amount of Australia was on fire and it just couldn't be put out. Like, people were fighting the fires for weeks. The fires weren't going out and it was burning. The Prime Minister had left the country and gone to Hawaii on a holiday. Unbelievably, this sense of the apocalypse is here, you know, and I think that fed into my mental state a little bit, as I kind of felt like I was living in the underworld to some extent. So that part of it was interesting to me. But in terms of Orpheus as a character and the underworld, I think just how he approaches the task that he's given and how this female version of Orpheus does, I thought a lot about the reasoning behind it, the mental state, what level of trust or lack of trust Orpheus might have in this situation, and how that psychologically could play into it as well. I also, I mean, part of why I was drawn to the story originally, I did have a lot of sympathy with the original Orpheus too, because I think just when you've been through that experience of bereavement with someone very close to you, you often just have these really strong thoughts about wanting to see them again, wanting to bring them back, like you'd do anything to be reunited with them. So to feel like that chance could be potentially slipping through your fingers, I can definitely understand why he would have turned around, and the sense that, you know, it's probably something that he would have dreamed about and thought obsessively about. The idea of losing that is quite frightening. So I think I do empathize a little bit with the original Orpheus as well. I can understand why he would make that decision, even if the outcome is frustrating.
Do you want to tell us about what you're working on next?
Yeah, I have been working on a couple of things, which I can't really say too much about, but I have read some fantastic books that I could mention. I really loved Winter Harvest. It has fantastic retelling of Demeter's story by Ioanna Papadopoulou. And I just loved how she portrays Demeter with this really captivating and frightening dualism. It's like she's a goddess who nourishes and feeds the world, but then the flip side to that is that she can take that nourishment away and starve the world. And I think she does a fantastic job of portraying that, that, you know, it subverts the idea of this mother figure as purely a provider by drawing attention to the potential for her as the provider to then become the withholder. So she could be this destructive force moved by anger about the injustices that are done to her. And I really enjoyed it. I loved how widely Ioanna uses her knowledge of Greek myth to bring in all these other characters in a way that feels very natural. Sometimes having such a wide range of character cameos and aspects to the story can feel like a lot, but I think she does a fantastic job of making it seem so seamless. So I really love that one.
Where can people find you online?
I'm on Instagram more often, and I'm also on X or Twitter under the name Elise John Books. So yeah, I'm mostly there, and I've also got a website as well with various links, and there's a page for the character art on there as well. There was some beautiful character art done of Orpheus and Eurydice done by an artist called Flero, so you can see that on the website as well as on social media.
When does the book come out?
Coming out in the UK on March 28th, and then a few days or a week later in the US, so very shortly after, at the beginning of April in the US.
Cool, so definitely keep an eye out for it, you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Elise. This has been such a fascinating conversation, and I really recommend Orpheus and Eurydice to everyone who's out there looking for a great myth retelling. You won't be sorry. The book is really beautiful, and it is perfect for fans of myth retellings and book clubs, so get out there and pick it up.
It is gorgeously written, highly recommended, really beautiful.
Oh, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it, for finding time to read as well. And I'm really looking forward to reading your book too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you all so much for listening. And we will see you whenever we see you next. Mm-hmm.